Glad you could spend some of your day with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. 46% of Americans have gotten at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. And some public health experts say a lack of healthcare access, or maybe the desire to have more information first, is what's holding the remaining unvaccinated folks back. Our next guest says critical thinking is a way to foster respectful dialogue and help people get on board. Donna Warren is a professor of philosophy at UW Stevens Point. She's also the director of the Critical Thinking Center at the university. So as we visit with her, how have you helped or convinced people, somebody close to you, to get their vaccine? What would you like to know about critical thinking? I hope you'll join in the conversation. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Professor Donna Warren, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm just thrilled to be here, Larry.
Well, let's first talk about critical thinking. Maybe you can explain it and why it's a good way to come to make a judgment.
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful question to begin with, because the area of critical thinking is sort of plagued with, I think, misunderstandings of what critical thinking is, or perhaps it's better to say a lack of clear understanding than any particular crisp misunderstanding. Some people just conflate it with good thinking generally, but at least at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, we try to adopt a slightly more targeted definition where it's essentially the process of thinking about your thinking in order to identify your reasoning, analyze your reasoning, evaluate your reasoning, and construct reasoning, both in order to decide what you want to think and in order to decide what you want to do. So it's intimately bound up with action and making decisions, like whether or not to get the vaccination.
And you're director of the Critical Thinking Center at UW Stevens Point. Maybe talk about the work that's being done there at that center.
It's a really new center. We started pretty much right before the pandemic hit, so we haven't had the opportunity to do as much work as we would like to do. But we have a variety of different constituents. One constituent, of course, is our own students. We are starting a critical thinking requirement in the general education course, in the general education curriculum, rather, at UWSP, which sort of sets us apart from many other institutions. We work with faculty, helping them to think about how they are already thinking about teaching critical thinking in their classes and helping them to maybe do that in a more intentional way. But we also reach out to businesses, both in order to get an understanding of what their critical thinking needs are in their employers, so that we can make sure that our graduates are really well prepared to enter the workplace, and perhaps ideally, in order to offer some perhaps, I don't want to say professional development activities, but maybe leadership growth activities for their current employees in the areas of decision-making and problem solving. And then thirdly, we work with community groups who might not be typically identified as employers, like local parishes or community foundations, areas or organizations that are really interested in cultivating civil dialogue among people who perhaps disagree with each other about some hot button issues, because that, as I think everybody knows, is something that we could work on collectively, just as a society.
You're absolutely right about that. Well, how then does critical thinking improve how we get things done?
That's a really good question, too. I can see why you have a talk show. You ask really good questions. I think one of the advantages to critical thinking is that it can cool things down. Now, that's when critical thinking is used correctly. There is a way, and I tried to warn my students against doing this and alert them to the fact that others do. There are people out there who are logic bullies, who are just hunting for fallacies in what other people say, to the extent that it's difficult for them to understand what people are saying. The first step, and the essential step, I think, in thinking critically, is thinking slowly and charitably about what other people are saying, in order to really understand them, because it's impossible for a variety of reasons to meaningfully engage people in dialogue about things that matter unless we extend to them that charity and that sort of active listening. So the first step in critical thinking is just to slow things down, get clear about what other people are saying. I think the second step in critical thinking is to slow things down and to get clear about what other people are saying. And the third step might be to slow things down and to get clear about what other people are saying. And then once you really think you have it, then you can meaningfully engage what they say. But I do think it's important to meaningfully engage what people say from a point of view that is self-reflective. So I would encourage people to not say, you should not think this, but rather, I do not think this because, right? You should not trust this source, but rather, I do not trust this source because you don't want to make people defensive, because that just shuts down dialogue. And dialogue is absolutely crucial to critical thinking that occurs in groups, as I think all important critical thinking must about complicated issues in a complicated society. So slow things down, get clear about what other people are saying, think clearly about that, and then engage from a position that does not, that will not make people defensive, I would say. Now, of course, that's how critical thinking would apply in contexts like the one that's kind of on the table now. Other rules would come into play if you're thinking critically about, say, something that's written in the New York Times or something that's written by Rene Descartes, where you're really not worried about engaging someone in dialogue, where you're confronted with a piece of kind of completely formalized reasoning and you're engaging it as an artifact. That's one thing, right? That's a related but slightly different skill set.
You know, I'm also a professor in the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison, and you may know the name Dietram Scheufele or Dominique Brossard, who have done a lot of work in this area, especially as it relates to vaccinations and other kind of high-tech things that come up. And so they have some thoughts about how public health experts might approach this whole getting the message out to people. And I, you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing a lot of the kind of things that they're talking about. How would you like to see public health expert use critical thinking to their messages to the unvaccinated? I know in our the researchers and my colleagues finds that oftentimes people assume that people just need more knowledge.
Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So maybe go from there.
yeah. That is certainly one part of the puzzle, right? One part of the puzzle is providing people with information. But I think another part of the puzzle is providing people with information in ways that make that information credible to them. Is the person providing that information recognized as trustworthy? And that can vary from group to group. So I do think it's important for the facts to be relayed to people by people who are trusted by the people who are going to get that information. So I think that's one piece. It's not just thinking that information floats free from the people out of whose mouth the information comes. It clearly doesn't. We rely upon testimonial evidence, but in order to rely upon testimonial evidence, we need to trust the person who's giving the testimony. So I would say that's the first thing. And then there's also understanding the implications of these, of any kind of epistemic or belief change. Sometimes the beliefs that we have are bound up with ways of life or social groups in such a way that we can perceive, justifiably or not, that changing our mind on certain issues could really cost us socially. If I'm a member of a group that has identified itself, for whatever reason, as being as being opposed to the vaccine, what's that going to do to my sense of belonging within that group? And I think it's not irrational for people to consider that, at least at some level, when they decide what they're going to believe, right? So I think that we also need to address that. And there's a variety of ways we can say that we by messaging, perhaps using people from the community, by noting that, you know, look, you can get the vaccine without thereby buying in to an entire worldview that you tend to identify yourself in opposition to. You don't have to become a Democrat, for instance, in order to get the vaccine. You don't have to become a Republican in order to do this or that. These are issues which can stand alone. So to help people to detangle that, maybe even by showing how getting the vaccination can actually fit well within other aspects of the commitments that are shared by that social group, like maybe a desire to be good community members, maybe a desire to really care for one's neighbor. If one can understand what's important in a values way, because our behavior is never, ever simply motivated by factual information. Our behavior is always motivated by factual information coupled with values commitments, right? No values commitments, you don't get the behavior. So I think you need to address both of those things in order to get people, to encourage people to do something.
Laura in Arpin, oh, you know what? I'm just noticing here. Laura, I hope you can hang on here and with your comments and questions, because it looks like you've got some good ones there. In the meantime, Donna Warren is our guest, UW Stevens Point Professor of Philosophy, and we're talking about critical thinking and as a way of helping perhaps improve the vaccination percentages that we have not only in Wisconsin but across the country. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back to talk with our guest, Donna, and also Laura from Arpin, and perhaps you. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about critical thinking on the show today with our guest, Donna Warren. She's a professor of philosophy and director of the Critical Thinking Center at UW Stevens Point. And we've been talking about using critical thinking as a way to get more people to get these COVID vaccinations. So how do you think public health officials should be communicating with those who are still hesitant to get the shot? We'd love to hear from you. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Callers online, let's take some calls. Laura in Arpin, thanks for waiting. And what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just before the break, we were talking about how important both facts and values are in that kind of critical thinking equation. And I feel like the most important thing that's missing right now is the human connection, or missing out on the emotional aspect of things. We're sharing lots of numbers, and we're sharing lots of, you know, very kind of hardcore facts. And that doesn't always speak to the heart. In 2007, my newborn son died from whooping cough. And a couple of years later, the county health department reached out to me and asked if I would share my story. And the one piece that I, like, it still just holds to this day, is that they had a special program for daycare providers. And they shared a lot of factual information and then offered those daycare providers the booster, the vaccination that would, you know, kind of help boost for pertussis and some other things too. And nobody accepted the vaccination. And then they shared the video where I was telling my story about what my son went through, about what it was like for our family. And after watching the video, almost all of the daycare providers accepted the vaccination. So I think it's really important to always remember the human side of things as well as the factual pieces.
Well, Laura, I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you so much for calling, and I'm sure Professor Warren has some comments of her own relating to your thoughts.
Yeah. I just want to echo Larry. I'm so, so sorry for your loss, and I could not agree with you more. I think in critical thinking, well, in studies of reason generally, we always want to say that, you know, data trumps an anecdote, just from a sheer point of view of what's more likely to be true. Follow the numbers. But in terms of motivating people, in order to get someone to really move, to hit them where they feel it, an anecdote trumps data psychologically, often. And there are really good reasons for this. There is something called the availability heuristic, which just means that we are sort of, all of us, are naturally programmed to more easily remember and to weight more heavily information that springs readily to mind. Well, what springs more readily to mind? A data table, an Excel spreadsheet, or a story? This is why when you hear about a plane crashing, for instance, you might be a little bit nervous about getting on a plane, even though intellectually you get the spreadsheet, right? You know that on average, flying is safer than driving. But that doesn't quite hit those emotion centers of your brain quite as much as the story that you saw on the news or heard on the radio about this tragedy, because you can more vividly imagine that. That's the availability heuristic. Those things are more available to you because they're emotionally tagged. And I do think that people who, one source in the reading that I've done, sort of, I'm not a public health specialist by any stretch of the imagination, but in order to get a better handle on the shape of this issue, I did do some reading about why people are resistant to vaccines. And I can tell you it's because of the anecdotes, right? It's because if I can tell a story about how someone had a reaction to the vaccine, or how someone might slough off, shed the vaccine, right, which does not happen, people can get scared by that because that's a story. And I think, unfortunately, people who are advocating for something that is designed to minimize dramatic stories will always be a little bit behind the eight ball here, because a truly successful public health effort, right, doesn't have tragedy associated with it. The point is to avoid tragedy. So that's always a challenge. So I think sharing stories is very important. And I just want to really thank you for what you did by offering your experience in that way.
Laura, again, thank you so much. I'm glad you hung on and had a chance to talk with us. I really appreciate it. Again, sorry for your loss. We'll give Arlene and Stephen's Point a chance to join us now. Arlene, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for listening. I have a question in terms of a baseline emotion for all of the fear of the vaccine is fear. And what I'm thinking is, how do you, even with the stories, break through the fear that people experience with this vaccine? Because they've heard so many different stories. Some are reliable, some are not reliable. Or with the young man that I was talking to last week, he really had heard no real stories. He just got pieces of information around. He hadn't heard any news things or anything. So my question is, how do you deal with that emotion more with what you are talking about, Donna?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Arlene. I think I would say to try to, if at all possible, to identify the source of the fear, and to try to provide information that might ameliorate that fear a little bit. For instance, by helping people to seek out good sources of information from the CDC, maybe, right? And also to acknowledge that there might be something called the naturalistic bias going on here. I think some people have a tendency to think that if something comes out of a lab, it's worse than if something doesn't, right? Which is, of course, not true. Lots of poisonous things grow in the garden, and lots of things that aren't poisonous come from a lab. But I think sometimes bringing those assumptions to light and say, are you thinking this? Actually, I would not say that. I wouldn't plant that in somebody's head. But just in case to be aware that is something that might come up, and then be able to address it. And to acknowledge that, fear is a healthy emotion sometimes. It can be an adaptive emotion. It's one of the emotions in which I personally specialize. So I know a lot about fear. But you might have like competing fears here. Given the fact that you don't want bad things to happen with the virus, you don't want to get this virus and not know exactly what it's going to do to you short term or long term, and you don't want to risk spreading it to others, and you also don't want to have bad consequences from the vaccine. Could we seek out information to decide which of those fears is more reliable, and realize that we can never operate under conditions of perfect certainty? The world just does not like that. You can never eliminate risk. You can only minimize it. So I think I might have those conversations. The one thing I wouldn't do for sure is to kind of mock the person for being afraid. Because, if people are afraid, they're afraid. So let's try to figure out why and maybe address those concerns.
Mm-hmm. Arlene, thanks so much. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of email, Steve emailed to ask if decisions are based on values and trust, as well as data and fact, how do we restore trust in this highly polarized society? How do we rebuild bridges that have been burned down?
That's
a big question.
That's a big question, and that's a central question, because I just said when I was thinking about Arlene's also excellent question, one thing you can do is you can appeal to sources of trustworthy information, like, say, the CDC. But we know that trust in the CDC has eroded a little bit for a variety of reasons, some of them having to do simply with this broader erosion of trust in a hyper-politicized environment. So, what can we do? I think the best thing we can do might not seem like very much, but if we all do it, I think we can make a huge impact. And that is to the greatest extent possible, stop eroding what I think of as the trust infrastructure by resisting the temptation that sometimes people have to mock people who have concerns like this, right? To call them names, to share memes about them. Because once that gets out there, then people are going to be much less likely, for good reason, to listen to you and to people who are sort of on your quote unquote team on this issue. So I really do think that this is an opportunity to really treat people the way we want to be treated, to extend to people the same kind of consistently charitable interpretation that we hope other people would extend to us. And if one person does it, one time on one day, it's not going to make a big difference. But if a whole bunch of us do it over time for many days, I think it would. But bridges are always a lot faster to burn down than they are to build, unfortunately, right? And right now we have a lot of burned bridges. and building them is going to take time. So I think it can be done, but it's not going to happen. Like, I just can't go out and say, everybody be nice to each other, be kind to each other, be charitable to each other, and have everything be okay. It's not going to happen. But I think over time it might. It will certainly improve things.
Thanks, Dee, for that email. Nancy in Platteville will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This is a wonderful show. Thank you. My thought about the whole vaccination conundrum is that to approach it from an existential platform where who we are as individuals is in large part personal responsibility. And if we extend that out, then we have community responsibility, because we live in the community that we are helping to create, and then extend that to global responsibility.
Yeah.
Comment on that, Donna?
I absolutely agree with you. That's a really wonderful insight, and I think it speaks directly to the need to articulate, or at least be somewhat aware of, the value commitments here, and to help people to understand that. And that sounds condescending, doesn't it? I think that everybody to some level does understand that. But if we can couch messaging about the vaccine in terms of this sense of responsibility, I think that's an excellent way to go, because I do think that most people do want to be basically decent human beings who are responsible not only for themselves and not only for their own family and not only for the people on their block, but for people broadly. And I think that tapping into that, I think, common human desire is a really smart thing to do.
So if somebody, let's say a friend says, well, I'm not getting a vaccine, I'm not going to get that vaccination, what's the approach that you would use to talking to that person about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. I think it depends upon the person. I mean, if this person is someone I know well, and I know that they inhabit sort of a worldview that is unreachable for mine in the short term. I mean, if I know that they have bought into what are, to my mind, baseless conspiracy theories, then I would think there's just no reason to have a conversation about this. And in fact, any conversation that I might have could serve to not only to burn whatever remaining bridges there are there. But if I'm dealing with someone I don't know well, or I don't think inhabits sort of a worldview that is that far removed from mine, I might just ask why. You have to be careful when you ask why questions like that, because if you say it with a kind of an accusatory tone of voice that sounds like this person is now on the witness stand, okay, why aren't you going to get? That's going to make people defensive and it's going to shut down conversation. But if you ask from a spirit of just genuine curiosity, really, why not? And actually find out why. Then let's just say that someone says, I'm concerned about the side effects. A good thing to do is to hunt when you have someone engaged in a conversation with you, is to try to find points of agreement, commonality. So I think that the wrong thing to do there would be to say, oh, that's nothing you need to worry about, that's a silly concern. But to say, yeah, I know, I was concerned about the side effects too, but I decided to have the vaccine anyway because. So again, speaking to your own decision-making process rather than telling them how they should think. That's what I would do, I think.
We have an opportunity for you to join in and give us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Somebody else wondered about doctors. How should a doctor talk with a patient You know, you say you've got a patient you've had for a year. How do you have a respectful dialogue with a patient?
Yeah, I think doctors are in a uniquely good position because presumably they have really they have access to some of the best and most current information. So I would say basically everything that I just said, with the added layer of, guess what, you can now, you can speak with some authority about, this is what the latest studies show. And I understand that you are concerned about this because, right, but this is what the latest studies show. So I personally don't have that concern. And I would support you in not having that concern as well. Especially because I think lots of people are getting their information, well, many people are getting their information from less than reputable sources, like TikTok videos or Twitter feeds, right, which spread essentially anecdotes. And as was noted earlier, anecdotes are incredibly powerful. They can be leveraged for good or for ill. So as a doctor, someone who's in that kind of trusted position, I think they are in a much better position to actually appeal to the data in a way that makes sense and in a way that matters to the patient. Because hopefully, if I have a doctor, the whole reason that doctor is my doctor is that I trust that doctor. So that's what I would say.
Yeah. And I would, as a doctor, I might say, well, I had some of those fears myself, but I did the vaccine and I had a sore arm for a day, but otherwise I was doing just fine.
Exactly.
Is that kind of thing helpful? I would assume.
Absolutely. Because again, that lowers any perceived social cost, if there is any. You know, if people like me, if people with whom I kind of identify myself or align myself are engaged in a certain behavior, that makes the behavior more imaginable to me. It's the sort of thing that I might do. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine a few years ago, and she was stunned to find out that I'd never been to a manicurist. She just couldn't imagine. How on earth could anyone never go to a manicurist? And I just said, well, I just don't do that, right? I just don't do that. And the only reason I don't do that is my family didn't do that and people around me didn't do that. But if someone at work said, hey, Donna, do you want to go to a manicurist? I might say, sure, right? Because now that's a behavior that's kind of in my social repertoire, so to speak. So, you know, for some people, maybe not getting a vaccine could just be like not going to the manicurist, in which case, knowing people who do, and knowing that you know people who do, can be really powerful.
Steven's point, do you have a quick question for us?
I do. So much of this is emotional driven. Is there a way to make the logic black and white, to put it in visible form so you have something objective to really look at?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is. You can't draw a picture of an emotion, of course, but there is a technique called argument mapping or reasoning mapping more broadly, that is really, really good for detangling the reasoning behind complicated issues. And we do a lot of that at Stephen's Point. So yes, there is something like that, and it's awesome. And I'd be happy if anyone wants to reach out to me to inquire about that. I would be more than happy to oblige. That's the kind of thing that you could call me up at 2 a.m. from a dead sleep, and I would be happy to talk to someone about that.
And by the way, I assume you have a website. The center has a website.
I do indeed. I think if people just Google my name or Google UWSP Critical Thinking Center, yeah. We do have a website. We have a Twitter feed. We have a Facebook page. Yes, indeed. We are real. We exist on social media. Ergo, we exist.
Donna, it was fun talking with you. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Just delightful, Larry. Thank you so much.
Oh, man. Professor Donna Warren, professor of philosophy at UW Stevens Point. She directs the Critical Thinking Center at the university. Fun talking with her and fun having you listening in. Just a look ahead tomorrow. PJ Leish is back to talk about black flies and cicadas and a tick app. So we're looking forward to that. And, of course, we have lots more in store. By the way, if you're busy in your garden, there's a new blog post up to help you with your plant selection. And I'll talk some more about that tomorrow. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.